From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Our first guest this morning, Robert Dunn, is a biologist, a writer, and a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at North Carolina State University. He has written several books, and his science essays have appeared at magazines such as Scientific American, Smithsonian, National Geographic, and others. In his book, Never Home Alone, now out in paperback, he introduces us to the nearly 200,000 species living with us in our own homes, from the Egyptian meal moths in our cupboards and camel crickets in our basements to the lactobacillus lounging on our kitchen counters. In short, you are not alone in your home. Yet, as we obsess over sterilizing our homes and separating our spaces from nature, we are unwittingly cultivating an entirely new playground for evolution. Good morning to you, Rob Dunn. Nice to have you.
Good morning. It's great to be on the show.
You tell the story of how, as a biologist, you were first, you know, going to the far reaches of the planet, you know, whether it's deep in the Amazon jungles or somewhere in Africa, to research microbes. But there's this dawning realization that you might not even have to book a plane ticket. You can research in your own home. How did that realization come about?
Wow. I mean, I guess it had multiple parts. I mean, one is that I started doing more and more teaching. And so I was working with students to figure out, well, what could they study around campus and close at hand and still make discoveries that was cheaper than flying a bunch of kids to the Amazon. And so we started to work some in backyards and some more also with the public. And so we would engage the public in what the students were doing, what I was doing. And as we did, we became more and more aware that there were things to discover, you know, right behind people's houses. Then we would have conversations with people about what was in their house. And I'd always thought that there was somebody studying the life in houses, and I could just leave that to them, and it was all understood, and I just didn't know about it. But every time somebody would ask about some species in the house, like, what do I do about this ant? What do we know about it? It would quickly become clear that for most of those species, nobody was studying them. And so we just sort of kept creeping indoors bit by bit, mystery by mystery, until we found ourselves under people's beds studying, you know, microbes, but also insects and all sorts of species that had just been kind of left there and ignored.
So if you talk about microbes, I think there's a lot of confusion in the world. We have antimicrobial soap, and yet we take things like probiotics with good microbes, and microbes exist all around us and inside us. And how do you know a good microbe from a bad one?
I mean, it's actually remarkably difficult to tell. I mean, we've now found more than 100,000 kinds of microbes in houses, and most of those have never, ever been studied. But what we do know is that for the things that are truly dangerous, it's really just a handful of the species that you commonly encounter. And so one thing to know is that most of the species around you are not dangerous. And then I think another useful thing to know is that most of the species that you would encounter, in the U.S. anyway, that might be dangerous are pretty quickly removed from your life by washing your hands with soap and water. And so, on the one hand, the truth is that most of the species falling on you every day, we don't really know. You know, as you're breathing in right now, we can't tell you which of those species are the most beneficial. But at the same time, we do know that, you know, if you live a life with some moderation, wash your hands with soap and water, don't try to kill too many things, that for the most part, that seems to do a pretty good job of leaving the stuff that we want around and getting rid of the stuff we don't want.
Rob, let's go back to the 1800s in London, when the cholera outbreak was particularly difficult. and the Broad Street Well and what you call miasma, which is, if I pronounce that correctly, which is odor, and how people thought that these terrible odors, if they were to smell them, that they could contract this cholera. Tell us about the story with Jon Snow and his research.
It's only very recently that we've begun to understand that a subset of microbes can be pathogenic and make us sick. And at this moment in London, it was only partially understood, and mostly in the context of plant pathogens. And so cholera was making people sick. Cholera was killing people all over London. And for the most part, the thought about what was happening was that there was some bad odor that was associated with making people sick, and that what you needed to do was to get away from the odor. And you can imagine that in some contexts, that might be a good enough proxy of what was actually happening, that maybe the bad odor is associated with rot, and rot is associated with pathogens. But what was happening in dense London was actually more complex than that, which was that cholera was getting into water systems and making people very sick. And so the bad smells were not actually indicative of what was causing the problem. And so what Snow started to do was to map, along with other people, where people were getting sick from cholera, to try to figure out, could he hone in on what the causative agent was? And he was able to identify a well that seemed to be the source of many of the cholera cases. And by closing off that well, it was later possible to make this direct sort of experimental link between the pathogen in that well and people getting sick. And so it was kind of this mapping process associated with a kind of experiment. But even at that time, there was not an understanding of what the actual organism making people sick was. And so it really took a whole series of steps.
Yeah, and I think that may have started, or you could tell us if his research for this particular well had anything to do with this, but people started to work a lot harder on trying to control the disposal of human waste in our urban areas.
Yeah, so there have been multiple moments of that in history, and this was one of them, that there started to be the understanding, as Snow's ideas were accepted about cholera, that you needed to disrupt the connection between feces and what we drink and eat in order to get rid of the pathogens that moved from feces to mouths to human illness. And so in London, it was Snow's work that really precipitated that change and much better water systems. But there are also earlier periods in history when people, without fully understanding what was going on, also developed better water systems. And so it was one of the things we had to learn multiple times before we did it very effectively. And the truth is that many parts of the world, it's still a major issue, making sure that people have water that doesn't have fecal oral pathogens in it.
Yeah, since we're on the subject of wells, I mean, talk to us about our water supply. So you get your water from a well, or if you live within the municipality, you get it from a system that may have varying levels of chlorination. What are the microbes in those two cases? How do they differ? And then how do they differ again if you have a municipal water system that doesn't use so much chlorination?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So once we started to understand that you needed to keep fecal pathogens away from water systems, there were sort of two approaches we could invoke. One was to keep the initial contamination from happening, and the other was to figure out ways to treat water that might already be contaminated in some way to make it potable. And so around the world, we've used both approaches. And recently, we bumped up against this sort of range of approaches in studying a super weird ecosystem, which is a little ecosystem that lives in your shower heads. And so if you unscrew your shower head and look up into the pipe, what you often see is a kind of what scientists call biofilm, but it's just a fancy word for gunk. And it's a kind of little apartment that bacteria poop to protect themselves. And it's almost always there. Sometimes those little apartments of bacteria include a thing called a non-tuberculous mycobacteria that if you're immunocompromised can be a health risk. And so we wanted to study, well, what determines where it's present and where it's not present. And one of the things that we saw is that for people whose water systems still relied on natural aquifers that weren't treated by big water treatment facilities and so didn't have much chlorine in them, and so this is true for the water of Vienna, for example, in Austria, mm-hmm. that we saw very few of those non-tuberculous mycobacteria. But we saw far more in water systems that were treating with a lot of chlorine. And what it looks like is happening is that when you treat the water with a lot of chlorine, you're killing a lot of bacteria, but you're leaving the bacteria that are a little bit resistant to the chlorine, which include these non-tuberculous mycobacteria. And so it's an absolutely necessary step if you don't have a water system that is sufficiently free of pathogens that you can just drink it from the ground. And yet it's a step that changes what's living in our pipes. And so it suggests both the ways in which we really need to protect natural aquifers in the first place and not contaminate them, but also how very complex it is to control these pathogens that are around us in our daily lives. That when there are hundreds and thousands and millions and maybe even trillions by some counts of bacteria, we're dealing with a very, very complex system.
That's a complex answer. If you're just joining us, our guest is Rob Dunn. He's a biologist, and he has written the book Never Home Alone, From Microbes to Millipedes, Camel Crickets, and Honeybees. It's the natural history of where we live. For those people who are worried about their shower heads right now, myself included, who live within a system where most of the good microbes or the weaker ones are filtered out by the chlorine, the stronger ones persist. Is there anything to worry about? Is there, isn't it tuberculosis or leprosy that the non-tuberculous microbe is somehow related to?
The non-tuberculous mycobacteria are distant relatives of leprosy and tuberculosis, but for the vast majority of people, you don't have to worry about them whatsoever. Keep showering. I don't want to accidentally cause stinky cities all across your listening area. If you're immunocompromised, the equation is slightly different, and there's more of a risk of these bacteria. But for most people, even if they're present in your showerhead, the risk is very, very minimal. And so go on showering and don't worry about them, and you encounter all kinds of much riskier risks every day.
Rob, we've all heard that fermented foods are good for us. My daughter was born in South Korea. Our family eats a lot of kimchi and other fermented foods. So we know it's good for us, but we don't know why. Can you tell us why that is?
So there are a lot of things happening with fermented foods. I mean, one of the things that happens is that you have a gut that's full of bacteria that help you to digest your food. And so one good thing those fermented foods can do is they can help to establish some of those living bacteria and other microbes from the fermented foods in your gut and sort of allow you to have extra abilities in terms of what you can digest and what nutrition you can get from that food. And so this is the case, for example, with some yogurts, where some of the microbes from the yogurt are actually establishing in you. And so it's a kind of superpower. The other thing that they do is that those same microbes allow us, I mean, thinking about our ancestors, allow us to eat foods that might not otherwise be very easy to eat. And so some human populations rely on lots and lots of milk products, even though they don't have the gene for being able to drink milk as adults. And they do it by eating fermented foods that get rid of the lactose in the milk and make it palatable. But I think for me, one of the other things about fermented foods is that they sort of re-engage our whole body in the microbial world around us. And so we know that if you're making fermented foods, some of the microbes from your body go into that food, and some of those become more common, and then you eat them again. And so it's a kind of a way of communing with your own microbes in an edible form. We did a recent experiment with bakers where we actually able to show that the microbes from the baker's hands often go into the sourdough starter that they're making, and influence the flavor of the resulting bread made from that sourdough starter. And so I think from a, you know, it's not health per se, but just a way of communing with your microbes, that kimchi and sourdough are a beautiful part of our human story.
Yeah, Robin, you tell the story, back to kimchi, about this group of people that are making kimchi. They have the identical ingredients, and at some point in the process, the cabbage is rinsed, it's cut up a certain way, and they have to start moving with their hands, moving shrimp paste or fish paste into the cabbage to, and shrimp paste and fish paste is also fermented, pre-fermented, and their hands and the microbe in the hands, even though they have identical ingredients, all the kimchi's come out different. Some are good, some are sweet, some are sour, some taste good, some don't taste that good. I mean, it's just fascinating, just that one little piece of putting your hands in the process can completely change the outcome of all the different kimchi's that they're making.
Yeah, that's right. There's even a Korean word, soma, which means hand flavor, which is that flavor that the person making the kimchi offers to the kimchi. And I think part of that is microbial. Yeah, we've long appreciated, even without knowing it, some of these benefits and beautiful things that microbes offer. Mm. And the same is true for lots of cheeses have body microbes in them, and they're doing similar things. They're helping to ferment that food and then allowing us to experience new flavors.
Oh, I wonder if I'll stop appreciating the varied flavors of kimchi, knowing now what I know. And same with sourdough bread, but it's all part of our natural world. So
I think when we start to learn about the names of species of microbes and learn about them as separate organisms, it's easy to become grossed out by them. But I think about that when we think about them as part of our food, if we don't call attention to them, we find wonder in them. And I think for microbiologists, this is a real challenge. How do we remind people of some of this wonder and some of the amazing things microbes do, even as we learn more about the details of what's happening in the process? And so I think things like soma, that sentiment of the hand flavor, you know, it's a microbial sentiment, but how do we remember that beauty, that power, that wonder? It's a challenge, and yet I think it's a challenge we have to rise to, because whatever future we imagine for ourselves, it will be a future in which we depend for many of our daily things on microbes. We can't escape our need for microbes, and we can't escape the challenges they pose. And so I think we need to rethink how we feel about some of these things.
Well, you make a really good point. And one way to think about it also is that the more we know about our health, and specifically our gut health, you know, making connections between our gut health and our brain health, how our brain functions, and that we know that gut health is largely dependent on the microbes and the bacteria in our gut and their presence to create that gut health. So I'm going to keep that in mind.
Yeah, that's right. And if you removed all the microbes from your body and from your food, you would be dead very quickly. You are not you without them.
We have a lot of realtors in Park City. And, you know, the real estate market's pretty solid, pretty strong. And transactions go through for lots of reasons, and transactions get killed for lots of reasons. But one of the reasons that I keep hearing about, I'm not a realtor, one of the transactions or one of the types of problems I hear that kills transactions is black mold. People freak out over black mold. They have to identify it. It has to be removed. Maybe this house is in a certain area where it's susceptible to that. And even if I have it removed, it's not going to work. And in reading your book, I learned that actual wallboard that comes in already has the fungi in it that makes up black mold, and all it has to do is get wet in some way, and the black mold will grow. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a mystery for a while. How does that black mold get into houses? Because it's not readily airborne. Birgitte Andersen, a Danish researcher, has recently shown that at least for the wallboard being sold in Europe, and I mean, almost certainly for that being sold in the U.S., that when she samples the brand new wallboard, then inside the wallboard you actually find the fungi just waiting. And it doesn't do well if conditions are dry, but it can hang out in the wallboard for a long, long time. And so it looks like this partially explains how it grows so, so quickly when your house gets wet. And we see this with hurricane damage a lot, that suddenly houses have black mold. How did they get so much so quickly? And it looks like part of the story is it's just waiting there, waiting for moisture. And so what do you do about that? I think one of the things is that if you know parts of your house have the potential to get wet, is to avoid using drywall wallboard in those places. And then obviously we could also intervene in the production of the drywall and figure out new ways to make it that gets the fungi out of the story. But that's less available to the average consumer and more of an industrial intervention.
Reading your book, we learned about your life as a youngster. You spent a lot of time outdoors playing, having fun. Lynn and I, as well, spent most of our time outdoors as kids. And you mentioned in the book that today's kids, they grow up indoors, 93% either inside a home or inside a vehicle. Is there any quantifiable data that says that that those kids are more susceptible to infections or to health problems because they're not outside communing with microbes and building up their immunities?
So there are data that show that kids that are less exposed to a diversity of microbes are at a much greater risk of allergies, asthma, and other autoimmune disorders. As you might imagine, because those sorts of problems are at the interface of the immune system and microbes, both of which are poorly understood, that we don't totally understand the mechanism of what's happening there, but it does seem clear that for kids that are really not exposed to lots of soil microbes and leaf microbes and outdoor microbes, that they are at a much higher risk for a lot of these problems that are becoming much more common. And so there have been some recent studies that highlight this. And for example, there's a study of Amish families and Hutterite families showing that although they have very similar genetic backgrounds, that the Amish who live lives still much more connected to their farm animals and to their farms outdoors are at a much reduced risk of allergy and asthma. And if you take dust from those Amish houses but not from Hutterite houses and you expose mice or rats that have allergies to that dust, you actually see some remission of the symptoms in the mice and rats. And so it suggests that it might be the case that even if our kids are not going to be spending as much time outside, there are ways to continue to expose them to what they need, but it's going to be complex.
That is fascinating. Rob Dunn, we're so glad you could join us today on Cool Science Radio. The book is Never Home Alone, From Microbes to Millipedes, Camel Crickets and Honeybees, The Natural History of Where We Live. Thanks, Rob. We appreciate you joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute. We'll be right back.